Please call the next case.
Commonwealth versus Jackson, Anna M. Hughes, Appellant's Counsel, Eric Weathers, Appellee's Counsel.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
Anna Hughes here on behalf of the Commonwealth, the appellant in this matter. May it please the court, I would like to respectfully ask for 3 minutes in rebuttal, please.
Okay.
Your Honors, the Court of Appeals erred in this case when it found that the Circuit Court penalized Mr. Jackson for pleading not guilty. In arriving at its holding, the Court of Appeals improperly fixated on isolated statements of the Circuit Court, failed to view the evidence in the light most favorable to the Commonwealth, and ignored the presumption that absent clear evidence to the contrary, the trial court knows and applies the law properly. Here, in finding that the Circuit Court explicitly linked Mr. Jackson's plea of not guilty with his failure to accept responsibility, the Court of Appeals relied almost exclusively on just one comment by the Circuit Court. And that was, quote, "I think it's fair at this juncture to argue that the opposite of acceptance of responsibility can be considered by the court in imposing sentence," end quote.
At any point did the trial court expressly state that its understanding of the basis of its finding for lack of claiming accepting responsibility was the fact that he put the Commonwealth to its proof? Did the court ever expressly make that linkage?
Did the Circuit Court?
Yes.
No, Your Honor, I don't believe so. And I don't believe that the record would support such a finding.
But he did lament having to spend hours dealing with this issue, and then in that same time frame talked about acceptance of responsibility. And so the question then becomes, are those two issues conceptually related, or is it just a judge saying one thing and then a judge saying another thing close in time, but they're actually not cause and effect?
Well, Your Honor, when we look at these statements that the Court of Appeals relied on, I think it's clear that the Circuit Court was not attempting to penalize Mr. Jackson, and that certainly was not its intention. And for example, when we look at this first statement that the Court of Appeals relied on, in that it's fair at this juncture to argue the opposite of acceptance responsibility, of course we have this presumption that the trial court, absent clear evidence to the contrary on the record, that there's a presumption that the trial court knows the law and applies it correctly. And here there is no clear evidence on the record to overcome that presumption. Nothing in the plain language of that statement explicitly linked Mr. Jackson's plea to his failure to accept responsibility. And viewed in context, the Circuit Court's comment that the opposite of responsibility may be considered at sentencing was simply an acknowledgement that in certain cases,
Do you agree that that was at least the Commonwealth's argument? I mean, the Commonwealth was arguing that because it was put to its evidence, he should be treated differently than had he accepted responsibility and didn't contest the allegation.
No, Your Honor. We do not believe that that was the Commonwealth's argument. When we look at the Commonwealth statements on the record, its argument, the Commonwealth expressly stated on the record that its argument had, quote, "nothing to do with him exercising his right," end quote, in reference to Mr. Jackson. I think that is pretty good evidence in this case that the Commonwealth was not attempting to punish Mr. Jackson for exercising his right. But further, the record shows that the Commonwealth was in fact discussing the sentencing range available under the then newly enacted or newly amended statute 19.2-306.1, provision A, which does indicate that in certain situations, separate adjudication hearings where there are multiple probation violations split up may affect the sentencing range that is available to that probationer if convicted. And I think when we look at that in context, it's clear that the Commonwealth was not arguing for his punishment, and that their other statements were simply an acknowledgement, again, that in certain cases, a defendant is perhaps appropriately rewarded for an acceptance of criminal responsibility.
Well, let's suppose for the sake of argument, the Commonwealth either misspoke or actually did intend to assert incorrect argument. As I understand the test, it is, quote, the trial court's present tense observation of a defendant's lack of remorse, so long as it is not explicitly linked to a defendant's prior claim of innocence or not guilty plea, or exercise of the right to remain silent, is an appropriate factor to consider at sentencing. So is there anything in this record where the trial court explicitly links the prior claim of innocence to the lack of remorse?
No, Your Honor.
So what more is there to the case?
Well, our position is that this is a situation where the Court of Appeals respectfully did err on this record in finding that the circuit court had explicitly linked Mr. Jackson's failure to accept responsibility to his plea and then punished him. Our position is that there was no such explicit link and that certainly the circuit court did not punish him. And that does lead me to my next argument, which is the Court of Appeals went one step further and determined that the circuit court here had considered Mr. Jackson's plea an aggravating factor and had given that significant weight when rendering its sentence. And our position is that that was error. Again, in arriving at its determination, the Court of Appeals relied on just one comment by the circuit court, and that was, quote, and then we're still not done, because we then, of course, also have all the matters that we spent I don't know how much time on today with respect to the other conditions that were violated in this most recent attempt at probation and for which responsibility was not taken. And that's a factor the court can consider amongst all the others I've just mentioned, end quote.
And on this evidentiary record, could the statement for which responsibility was not taken refer to the excuses that were offered, the motorcycle accident and a lack of communication for the probation officer, as opposed to putting the Commonwealth to its proof?
Yes, I believe that would be a fair interpretation, Your Honor. And again, I would point to the presumption that the trial court understands what it is allowed to consider at the sentencing phase and for what purpose.
And those excuses were in the sentencing phase of this. Am I right?
I believe the record reflects that there was a proffer made at the sentencing phase by the defense counsel in which she spoke again about his accident and...
So he's still making excuses during sentencing, not taking responsibility, and the trial court in a present tense analysis said, okay, I take that into account. Did the trial court give the maximum available even on the condition one violations?
No, it did not, Your Honor. And I think that that is important here in considering the court's judgment. The court imposed, I think it was less than half of the time that it could have imposed given Mr. Jackson's violation.
Even if there were no technical violations at all?
Even if there had been none, yes. And he admitted to the condition one violation. So, and
how
I think
that... How many prior felony convictions did this gentleman have?
Your Honor, his record indicated, it was referenced he had 20, I want to say, but I would have to go back and defer to the record. I know that there is a part here. It is very lengthy. It is very lengthy, and that was certainly a consideration that the circuit court had when it was considering the appropriate judgment to impose in this case, and that the court made a conscientious judgment and a very careful judgment, I think is apparent on this record, and in the fact that he imposed less than half the time that he could have even given the admission. And I would just like to note that I think the best evidence in this case of what the circuit court considered an aggravating factor is evident in the court's own list of what it considered to be aggravating factors. And those were three things. First, that the new offense was of a similar nature to those for which Mr. Jackson was on probation. Second, that he had prior active sentences in the defendant's criminal history that dated back to 2002. And three, that there were violation of multiple other conditions while on probation. Nowhere on that list is Mr. Jackson's plea, of course.
Was that in the sentencing order or in the guidelines forms?
That was in the guidelines form.
And the what I'm concerned about is, and I don't really have much of an issue with really anything you're arguing, but I'm concerned that we might be putting too much emphasis on what's contained in the guidelines form when really that's not the purpose. The purpose is if there is a departure up or down, that has to be noted on the guidelines, but does that have the same force as an order?
Well, I think for purposes of this analysis, it's important and in fact critical.
It's evidentiary, but is it binding? Is it an order?
I don't think the sentencing guidelines are an order, Your Honor, but I do think that they are necessary and a critical part of the analysis here when the heart of the issue is what did the circuit court consider to be an aggravating factor? And did that include Mr. Jackson's plea? And the answer here is no, it didn't. And we know that because of what the circuit court itself told us on this record. And so we would contend that that is the best evidence of what the court actually considered. And then, of course, we also have an argument that even had the circuit court considered Mr. Jackson's plea to a failure to accept responsibility at sentencing, that was permissible for the limited purpose of determining whether to reward him a sentencing reduction for that acceptance of responsibility. And of course, on brief, we pointed to the federal cases which have been looking at acceptance of responsibility in the federal guidelines for quite a while and indicate that they have consistently held that a court may consider a defendant's plea in determining whether a defendant has accepted responsibility, and importantly, that a decision not to reward a defendant with that acceptance of responsibility is not a penalty. And so even if the court
had... You're down to your 3 minutes.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. Respectfully, I would like to save the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you, Your Honors.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Eric Weathers here today on behalf of Mr. David Jackson. Appellate courts read appellate records in their full context. And read in context, this record shows that the trial court penalized Mr. Jackson for contesting.
The test here is explicit. It's not implied context. You might have a point if we could go beyond the word explicit, but that is the test. And ironically, in Lawler, Justice Lemons' opinion in a death penalty case actually found, the court found, that there was, in fact, impermissible reliance on the lack of remorse. But the holding was, and to quote it, is nevertheless the court gave greatest weight to other factors. But the Court of Appeals' opinion doesn't even analyze this harmless error type of analysis. It didn't weigh it at all. It made it a per se rule. So I'm finding multiple layers of problems with your argument.
Well, first, there are four aggravating factors that are considered in this case. And one of those aggravating factors is Mr. Jackson's plea. Or to go back to a question.
Was it the plea or was it the failure to accept responsibility?
It was linked to his plea. The failure to...
Where? Give me your best statement that they are tied together explicitly.
They're explicitly tied together where the court first mints this opposite of acceptance of responsibility factor. So going to page 120 of the joint appendix here, it's important to look at what comes before the statement that the Commonwealth is focusing on here and that the Court of Appeals ultimately pointed to. And what comes before that sentence, that statement, is the Commonwealth saying, in any event, he pled not guilty, and counsel objecting, Your Honor, again, she's making arguments based on my client exercising his trial rights, which he does have in a probation violation hearing. And at that point, the court doesn't say, well, no, she's not, or, well, I'm not going to consider that.
Once defense counsel said that, the Commonwealth actually said something before the court said something, and what the Commonwealth said was, no, That's not what I was saying at all. It was a statement that he required six different hearings. And so in asking that question, I'm just wondering out loud, did defense counsel kind of inject this whole misunderstanding into this argument?
If that's what happened, if the Commonwealth was starting from this interpretation of 306.1, that's not what's happening at page 120 of the joint appendix here. We're beyond where the Commonwealth first says this has nothing to do with the plea.
Well, then Commonwealth, the judge says it has nothing to do with Jackson exercising his right.
He said that the bottom line is that there are new law violations and that 3 years and 21 months is available. I mean, as Justice Kelsey just said, I mean, that the trial judge in that time frame said that he was looking at the technicals and he was looking at the underlying law violations.
The conversation doesn't stop there. The conversation continues to the next objection of considering the fact that he exercised his trial rights. And at that point, the court mints this factor of the opposite of acceptance of responsibility.
Well, exercising the trial rights, and tell me if I have my recollection right, the trial judge is saying, look, it's you, defendant, that wanted to atomize all of these technicals like this. You didn't have to do it this way. Could have just cobbled them all together.
I don't believe that's a fair reading of this record, and I don't believe that that has anything to do with the acceptance of responsibility. That doesn't flow naturally from the Commonwealth saying, you separated these pleas out, and then the court says, well, I guess I can consider the opposite of acceptance of responsibility.
But the judge never said that. You're reading a lot into the record, and I'm trying to tell you the record is pretty unclear which way you can read it. You can read it the opposite direction equally. And the test is, why are we reading anything in the record? It's got to be explicit.
To me, it is explicit. It's explicit when there's a discussion about the effect of his plea.
Recognizing that you believe it's explicit and 100% clear, if the record can be read in two ways, given all of the standard of review, presumption that the trial judge is applying the law correctly, and the facts of this case, if it can be read in two ways, the Court of Appeals erred. Your position is it can't be read, and I'm not asking you to concede that it can be read in two ways. If it can be read in two ways, the Court of Appeals erred.
The test is looking for a clear abuse of discretion. If that means that there are two equally plausible explanations for this discussion, then I think you're right. But
Even if your reading might be the better one, given that we have to presume that the trial judge, and we don't look at a statement and applied the law correctly, and given that we can't isolate a statement and just look at it without looking at the whole thing, if there is another plausible reading that he did not punish him for putting the Commonwealth to its proof, I don't like the phrase not guilty because that's not what this proceeding was about. If the record can be read that way, then the Court of Appeals is in error.
I'm not convinced that it has to be 100% to 0% in terms of how you can choose to read the record to find a clear abuse of discretion. I don't believe that that's the standard, but yes, I think if they're in equipoise, I don't know that that would show a clear abuse of discretion.
Do you agree that Mr. Jackson gave, in his presentation, reasons that could lead a court to find he did not accept responsibility absent the fact that he put the Commonwealth to its proof?
No, I don't. And
you don't think saying that the probation officer didn't clearly inform me of what I was supposed to do and then that I had problems with the motorcycle accident, that couldn't be interpreted by the trial court as offering excuses and not accepting responsibility that he failed in his obligations?
No. And my reason for that is because Virginia trusts trial judges to separate out what is presented during a guilt or innocence phase or the first part of a revocation hearing in this case, and what is presented present tense at sentencing, which occurred after the fact here. The Commonwealth cited to the excuses that Mr. Jackson made at sentencing. Their cite to the joint appendix is in the argument at the guilt or innocence phase. There's nothing in what is presented at sentencing that rings in even the same kind of tenor as what is being called an excuse here. But even so, Lawler says that whether the defendant expresses remorse at sentencing is a proper factor for consideration, and the trial court may weigh the credibility of any such expression, provided it does not consider the defendant's prior legal positions when doing so. So that draws a clear line between what is being presented.
But you know, the holding in Lawler was that even if that occurred, which they said it did occur in a death penalty case, nevertheless, the holding says, after finding that there had been this improper consideration, it is clear from the record that in evaluating the question the court considered and gave the greatest weight to the statutory sentencing report, the evidence adduced at trial, including Lawler's mitigating evidence in the penalty phase, et cetera. These are all proper factors for the court's consideration. Accordingly, the court did not abuse its discretion in denying Lawler's motion. You get this, right? They're finding that there was, in fact, an impermissible use of this factor. But in the context of the case, and here we have a man with almost 20 or maybe 20 or more felonies, his condition one violations warrant more time than he actually got. We could have written off all of the technicals and it wouldn't have affected this case at all. And the case you're relying upon had an actual finding of misconduct, abuse of discretion, but nonetheless said it wasn't the greatest weight, going back to the balancing test you were just asked. So how do you address Lawler? I mean, no one addresses this on brief. I don't understand that because it seems to me to be directly on point.
So I would disagree with your characterization of Lawler to some extent, Your Honor. I don't believe that there's a finding of the Lawler factor actually being met, because what the court says is that it wasn't given significant weight relative to the other.
No, if you look the paragraph earlier, it was not an appropriate factor to consider in weighing Lawler's sense of remorse at the time of sentencing.
Right, and there are two parts to the Lawler factor, considering an improper factor and giving it significant weight. So where Lawler stumbles is significant weight. Here, the trial court enumerated four aggravating factors.
I think you just made my point. There is a harmless error concept baked into this doctrine. One is, did you consider this factor? Yeah, maybe not. No, I didn't at all. And then next is, well, so what? I mean, what else are we looking at here?
Right, so I would say that this is separate from harmless error as well.
It's very similar doctrinally, but you're right. The words saw harmless error are not in the paragraph, but go ahead.
But however it's characterized, in this case, there's a whole pile of factors that are considered by the court and a much lengthier transcript on what the court was giving significant weight to there, and the court didn't give significant weight to this factor in Lawler in relation to the other factors. Here, there are only four total, three others. To say that the court didn't give significant weight to something that it told Mr. Jackson was an aggravating factor, which it defined as something that would lead the court to a higher sentence.
Well, I'm not conceding in my question to you that this case involves even a violation to begin with, because you keep calling it clear, but it's not explicit. It's implied if it's anything. It's not explicit.
I disagree with that as well, and yes, for the reason that I gave earlier, but again, when the court is enumerating its aggravating factors, it refers to this factor.
Lack of remorse at sentencing. He's still making excuses even now.
And even if that refers to what was presented in Mr. Jackson's defense, that would still be a violation of Lawler. That would still be an improper factor. And the Commonwealth said it's fair to read the record that way. So the court considering that, linking that to the plea, linking that to what was presented during the guilt or innocence phase, the court is considering an improper factor. That's the first step of the Lawler analysis checked off. Then the court goes through the aggravating factors that it's considering, says these are the factors that lead the court to a higher sentence, and it names the technical violations and for which responsibility was not taken, that is a factor the court can consider amidst all the others I've just mentioned. The court names this factor as something that is leading it to a higher sentence. That is not
lack
consistent.
Lack of remorse, which is an appropriate factor.
Not when it's linked to
a guilty plea or not guilty plea. Where is it explicitly linked?
It is explicitly linked when the court finds it appropriate to mint this factor immediately after the discussion focuses on Mr. Jackson's plea. That is how the court deals with the fact that the plea has come up. What the effect of the plea is to say, well, I can consider if there has been an acceptance of responsibility. So given that discussion about the plea, I do think it's appropriate at this juncture to say that the opposite of responsibility can also be considered. So that's where it's most explicit in the record. And either way you slice it with what the court is connecting it to, it is an improper factor, given significant weight. And the error is not harmless. I want to point the court to the harmless errors standard that I think is appropriate here, which is from this court's opinion in Turner versus Commonwealth. There, an error in admitting polygraph test results into evidence at a revocation hearing was not harmless because this court said that it cannot ascertain from the record the extent, if any, to which the error may have contributed to the punishment imposed. So if the factor is at least a contributing factor in the court's sentencing decision, it's not harmless. If the court gave it significant weight, that means that it's weight that had an effect on the sentence, that is at least a contributing factor in the sentence. The court says, this is one of the four factors that leads me to a higher sentence.
And Lawler, was it a contributing factor?
It was not a contributing factor in Lawler. And
Lawler's defense strategy in the 22 months preceding trial, including his assertion that Delgado may have committed the murder and his concomitant denial of responsibility and implied, was not an appropriate factor to consider in weighing Lawler's sense of remorse at the time of sentencing.
Right.
So that's not a contributing factor.
And this court found that it was not a contributing factor because the court made the same decision. It didn't give it the weight that had an effect on its decision. It's also important to recognize, I think, that Lawler is a question of whether there was good cause to set aside a jury's verdict of death, sentence to death. That's a very different standard, I would say, than to say what played some role in the alchemy that is a trial court sentencing decision.
A death penalty case should get a lower level of harmless error.
It's not that it should get a lower level of harmless error. I think that it's a different question about whether considering the factor has an effect at all in the context of good cause. And I see I'm out of time, but I would ask this court to affirm the judgment of the Court of Appeals.
Thank you, counsel. You have 2 minutes and 53 seconds for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, because there was a lot of discussion about harmless error, I'd like to just briefly talk about harmless error. It is one of our contentions on brief that the Court of Appeals erred by failing to conduct a harmless error analysis in this case. We do believe that if the court had conducted that analysis, they would have found that even the alleged error here was in fact harmless. And again, I would point to that record, which indicates that the circuit court's sentence was driven by Mr. Jackson's new criminal offenses. They were of a substantially similar, or were similar, but escalating nature to those for which he was already on probation, his lengthy criminal history, and his failure to act in a law-abiding way despite periods of incarceration previously, and the sheer multitude and variety of his violations. And all of this, again, is expressed in the court's written finding on the sentencing guidelines form. And the record shows that because the court clearly was giving the most weight to those factors as aggravating factors, any error here, even of the type alleged, would have been harmless. And so, Your Honors, respectfully, we would ask that this court reverse the Court of Appeals.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.